old mansions along the Mississippi.
Uh-huh.
And they were bestsellers. And I knew him, so I think he died about 20 years ago.
You were born when, Eustace? Oh, let me say this. We're at the Euro, what do they call it, Euro Unity?
Euro-American Conference.
Euro-American Conference in New Orleans, and it's the 22nd of May, 2005. We're interviewing Eustace Mullins, famed author, and I was just asking, where were you originally born, Eustace?
Oh, in Roanoke, Virginia.
Roanoke.
Yeah.
And you're descended from the famous Mullins on the Mayflower, right? Or
William Mullins. William. He had the French name, Guillaume Moline, but it was during the Huguenots persecution, and he was a Huguenot. And you see, the French destroyed their chance for a future because the church and the state and the army in old France owned everything and all the power, and suddenly this rising class of entrepreneurial, the best and the brightest in France, mm-hmm. started rising up, and William Mullins was one of those people. And they couldn't stand the competition, and so they started murdering all the Huguenots.
They drove them, and they went to England?
Well, William got out and took his family to England, and they survived.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones that stayed there, they were all killed.
Yeah.
Massacred. And ever since then, France has gone down in history because they lost their best blood.
I was told that the height of the average Frenchman decreased 6 inches because of Napoleon's wars. They used to be originally a tall people.
Yes.
That's true.
Well, E. Cummings told me that many times. He was a great friend of mine in New York. And Cummings used to say, and I guess it was a widespread saying at that time, he said, Napoleon took off 6 inches off the height of every Frenchman.
That's what I heard, too.
And it must be a common saying.
Yeah.
You see, Cummings was in France during World War I. And they imprisoned him as a spy. He was there as a Red Cross worker, and he was thrown into prison and in a dungeon for about 18 months.
Wow.
And finally the American consulate got him out.
Mm-hmm. You've really known some of the big movers and shakers in history. You've known just about everybody that's really worth knowing.
Well, I seem to be guided to them, and when I meet them, we hit it off. Like people like H.L. Hunt and Ezra Pound, I was associated with them years, and we never disagreed about anything. It was a total meeting of the minds.
You actually worked for Hunt for years, right?
I wrote 3 books with him.
And you knew Joe McCarthy?
And Joe McCarthy. I did the critical work for Joe McCarthy. I did a special 24-page report from the Library of Congress, which identified the source of communism, not as the little Jewish shoemakers, which Congress claimed they were, but as the international bankers, the Rothschilds, and you see, communism itself was anti-capitalist. Yet supposedly, you had capitalism and communism, and the Rothschilds financed both parties.
Right. So much for that.
Yeah.
Now, you also broke the original story on the Federal Reserve. That's quite a detective story.
It is a detective.
And you did that through your acquaintanceship with Ezra Pound, right?
Well, not only, it was not merely an acquaintanceship. You see, I had become Ezra Pound's legs. He was in prison for life without trial in a mental institution, and he couldn't go out to the library and get books. And when I came to visit him, he said, go to the Library of Congress and see what you could find about the Federal Reserve System.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, at that time, I had never heard of the Federal Reserve System, like most Americans. And so I went to the library about this esoteric subject, and I found the whole world opened up. And I came back and showed Ezra what I found out, and he said, you've got to write this as a detective story.
And that was the original breakthrough and on exposing the Federal Reserve. And then,
oh, there's 18 copies of my book floating around now under different names, and it's all my work.
And all they do is change the author. They don't even bother to change the text.
Well, some of them have even printed it with my name on it.
Oh,
well, it gives it more authenticity.
And so you were originally born in Roanoke, Virginia.
Yeah.
And how long did you live there?
My family lived there until the height of the Depression in 1934. My father was out of work, and so he found a job in the town of Stanton, which is 100 miles north.
Uh-huh. And that's where you live today.
And I've stayed there ever since.
But you, as far as your education, I think you went to school in Mexico and New York. Tell us about your education.
Well, my principal education was at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia, which was founded by George Washington himself, and which was, after the Civil War, General Lee, he was offered enormous job opportunities in New York to head life insurance companies and banks and everything, but instead he chose to, it was a small struggling college at that time, mm-hmm. and he chose to become president of Washington Lee. Mm-hmm. And when he became Washington Lee, it was Washington Academy, and after he became the president, they changed it to the name Washington Lee, which it has today.
Mm-hmm. And what year did you go into school there?
1946, after leaving the Air Force. I served throughout World War II in the United States Air Force.
Oh, that's right. And I remember you telling a story during an interview about marching up and down in Florida on the beach, mentioning Roosevelt. So you were talking, tell them about that, the little story about Fella.
Well, during World War II, it was remarkable, but there was absolutely no sentiment for the war against the troops, because I was one of them. And we would march to work every day singing ribald rhymes about I love Fella. I love America. I hate war. And we were marching up and down singing this as a march, you know. It was all totally disrespectful. Now, one of these kids, they were all kids like myself. They had not the slightest allegiance to Franklin D. Roosevelt whatsoever.
And you said you had talked to, or Evelyn Waugh said the same thing about Churchill, didn't he?
Evelyn Waugh said that when he was an officer in the British Army in World War II, they sat around every night making fun of Winston Churchill, the great leader, when he came on the radio, and the British hate pomposity, and he was the most pompous, arrogant person you ever saw in your life. And so whenever he came on the radio, the whole, this loyal officer corps would sit there making fun of the great leader.
And he was in an underground bunker like six stories below the streets of London, right?
Yes, he was totally untouched during the war.
And you said they used to give him a couple of quarts of whiskey and just let him go down in his bunker and drink himself senseless. Right?
Two quarts a day. He always drank
two quarts a day, man.
Yeah. He was totally pickled. He lived to be about 90 years old because his entire system was totally pickled. He could never die.
His father, his father was a syphilitic, right?
Oh, yes.
Randolph Church.
Randolph. Well, there was a lot of syphilis in the British upper class at that time, and Randolph was very typical. He was a womanizer, and he slept with various women, and so he probably never knew which one he got it from, which is usual.
And after, when Churchill got into the hands of the Jews, it was when he was living at Chequers, right? And he got into a big debt, and he was going to lose the Chequers. Why don't you tell us that story, how the Jews...
He was totally wiped out, and he was going to lose the family estate. Of course, Winston Churchill was a poor relation. You see, his ancestor, the Duke of Marlborough, Churchill, had become very wealthy by betraying the nation of England during a war, and betraying them to William of Orange, and that's how William of Orange became King of England, and that's when he set up the Bank of England in 1694, the first central bank. And that's the Bank of England, as a central bank, took over the entire world. We talk about the British Empire, it's actually the Bank of England Empire. That's all it's ever been. Mm-hmm. In fact, I got a letter from a resident of Canada, a book, a few weeks ago, by Harry Townsend, called Canada, in which he says that Queen Elizabeth has never been Queen of England because the Queen is chosen by the Chancery Court. She is the Queen of the Chancery Court. That's all she is. She's not Queen of England.
I don't expect she would like that to get out.
Well, it never got out before, but the Canadians are very bold, forthright people. They're like they're the same as Americans. Mm-hmm. And so this man wrote this book, and I got this book and I was in the mail one day, and I was so astounded by it that very night I went on a radio talk show and talked for 3 hours about it and told other people what I just found out.
let's see, let's go back to the Federal Reserve System. The people that, Felix Warburg was sent over here from Germany, right, by the Rothschilds to set it up, right?
He had been an apprentice in the House of Rothschild, and so as a young rising star, he was sent to the United States to form the most important. See, part of the mythology of the Rothschilds is that they missed out on investing in America, and in fact, they were totally controlled America through two firms. One was called Kuhn-Loeb, and one was called J.P. Morgan Company, and they were subsidiaries of those Rothschild.
Loeb, if you wanted to do business with Jew bankers, you would use Loeb, and
that was well known in Wall Street.
And then if you wanted to do business with Christians, you did what was it? J.P. Morgan.
J.P. Morgan,
which was really another.
And it was all the same outfit. But that's the way the Rothschilds operated. They were masters of disguise and subterfuge. And so if you were a Christian millionaire in New York, you put your money with J.P. Morgan. And if you were Jewish, you put your money with Kuhn-Loeb. And they all thought they were so secure because my money is with my own people.
Right. So Warburg, it took him how long when he came over here? I understand he had a huge salary in those days.
$50,000 a year, which is $50 million a year.
Yeah. And it took him, a couple of years behind the scenes to get the meeting at Jekyll Island. Why don't you tell him about that?
Well, he didn't. The real mastermind of the meeting at Jekyll Island was John D. Rockefeller.
Oh.
You see, John D. Rockefeller, with the Standard Oil Company, had become the greatest monopoly in the world and the greatest corporation in the world because the Rothschilds, again, had financed the entire expansion. He was a $10 a week clerk in a little office in Cleveland, Ohio. And this $10 a week clerk became the richest man in the world. So you want to know how it's done? It's done while you ally with the Rothschilds, and the next thing you know, they write this man is the richest man in the world.
Well, the Rothschilds are still exerting their influence because he snapped his fingers and Warren Buffett and the governor of California came over and they were seen at his estate. Well, did you know Warren Buffett probably represents the Rothschilds here?
He represents the Rothschilds, and I'm told that Warren Buffett has been a very powerful influence on the CIA. So he would be on all the drug smugglers, the same with George Bush. You're in on the drug smuggling, and you're in on the covert operations of the CIA. They have a black budget. Nobody knows how much money they have or who gets it. It's a wonderful way to do business.
Didn't you say the British crown was involved in the drug trade in China and Far East, right?
Well, it all started with the British Empire because the Chinese people wanted to get out of the influence of drugs and to keep the people from smoking opium all the time. And so they were cleaning it up, and the British Empire came in and forced the drug trade to continue and killed off the Chinese royal family who tried to help their own people and to free their own people from the influence of drugs. And they killed them all, and they sailed right ahead and made more money than ever.
And didn't some of America's wealthiest families, weren't they part of that trade too?
Well, I can give you one name. Frederick A. Delano became the biggest opium dealer in Hong Kong, and he was American, he wasn't British. And with the fortune that he made, the Roosevelts were a ne'er-do-well family, and they weren't making any money, but the Roosevelt girl married Delano's son, and became the father of Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
That's a little history we never learn in the history books.
Well, you're not going to find it anywhere in the world because you're only going to hear it from me. I don't have any monopoly on it. I have no copyright. You can quote it as much as you want. But right now, I'm the only person that tells you about that. And this is a matter of record which was first exposed by the foremost columnist in the United States at the time, who was Westbrook Pegler. And Westbrook Pegler was a columnist with the Hearst chain. And he broke the story about the opium kings of the Roosevelt Delano family, and he was denounced everywhere for such a cruel libel.
Yeah, truth hurts, doesn't it?
It was not libelous at all because all the money that the Roosevelt family had was the opium money.
And also the Queen of England, wasn't she involved in all of that, the family?
Lyndon LaRouche campaigned in Washington for years, saying that Queen Elizabeth was the biggest drug trader in the world. And so they lampooned LaRouche unmercifully for saying that this little old lady was standing on the street corner at Piccadilly Square selling dope, which of course she wasn't. And it was simply that she was the titular head of the dope trade, the same way she was the titular head of the Anglican Church. She had a number of titles like that, but she didn't run the Anglican Church and she didn't run the drug trade.
She just pocketed their proceeds, right?
Well, they're on a, you know, the English royal family, in the Royal Succession Act of 1703, they became employees of the British government. And they're working just like everybody else on a salary.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But they don't pay any income tax. So they get wealthier every year. They're worth billions of dollars. The last thing that I think Fortune printed about 15 years ago, that Queen Elizabeth was worth $15 billion. No one knows what she's worth because the palaces and the artwork that she owns are worth probably $100 million.
She has a pretty good gem collection, too, right?
Gems and art and palaces.
Carriages, castles.
Well, it doesn't take but a little bit of that to become a very respectable market of money. I mean, any American would be glad to own 1/100th of what is in Elizabeth's name. I don't think she could sell any of it, really, because it's all in hock to the British government.
I know you are an authority on how the Rothschilds got started.
I really am, yeah.
And how, with the loan, why don't you go into that?
Well,
was it King?
The Rothschilds became the richest family in the world through the courtesy of the American government. And the reason that happened was when the Americans, colonists, struck out for independence, King George III realized he could not trust his own troops to fight the colonists because they were all cousins, you know.
Right.
I mean, how do you have people in British troops come to the United States, or the America at that time, and start shooting down their cousins? So he went to the, he asked around in Europe, well, where can I get some reliable troops? And they said, well, go to the Hessians in Europe. And so he went to Germany and talked to the Elector of Hesse, and the financial manager of the Elector of Hesse, who was then the richest man in Europe, was Hampshire Mayor Rothschild. And so Hampshire Mayor Rothschild arranged for the sum of about £5 million at that time to rent soldiers to the King George III. And that £5 million became the basis of the entire Rothschild fortune, because the Elector of Hesse, of course, turned to Hampshire Rothschild and said, invest this money for me. And a couple of years later, Hampshire Mayor Rothschild came back, and his money had multiplied from £5 million to £25 million. So, of course, that went all over Europe. If you want to get rich, let the Rothschilds invest your money. So they all flocked to the Rothschilds.
But didn't Rothschild actually make like $50 million, and
only
gave the elector 25?
Oh, because when you get in on the ground floor of a new company or a new country or something like that, £1 million becomes £100 million in a couple of years. And that's what happened, because they had the inside track everywhere, and he invested the money, and but the Elector of Hesse was overwhelmed that he suddenly was worth £25 million. And he was already very rich anyway. These people had palaces. They live like nobody lives in the United States today. I mean, the Rockefellers, they have a little house on the banks of the Hudson in New York. Well, the house of the Rockefeller Mansion in New York would only be a carriage house in any
Rothschild place,
any aristocratic family in Europe.
They have different tiers. You said I'm on one of your tapes, one of your talks. They have the different levels of the hierarchy. You've got the the food chain, or the pecking order is.
Oh, the pecking order is very rigid. It's like the ancient Egypt pharaohs. I mean, you can only move one step at a time. There's no such thing as being promoted over everybody, which Roosevelt himself, he was looking for a stooge in World War II, and there was a little army major who had failed miserably at every assignment he'd ever done, and he was very much despised by his senior officer, who was General Douglas MacArthur. And so,
you're talking about Eisenhower.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about Eisenhower. And so Roosevelt's chief advisor was a Jewish lawyer named Stephen Rosen. It wasn't Rosenthal or Rosenblatt. I can't think of the exact name. But anyway, he was his chief advisor. And he said he knew this young officer who was very good. And so so Roosevelt sent his daughter, Anna Roosevelt, who later married a good friend of mine,
Colonel Dahl. Yeah.
And so she went out to talk to Eisenhower about her father. And when she mentioned her father, Eisenhower launched into effusive praise about Roosevelt as the greatest man in American history. And so she went back and reported that this Major Eisenhower really revered Roosevelt. And so he made him chief of the army. And he was a person who had failed at everything he had done, and suddenly he's head of the U.S. Army.
Not only the U.S. Army, the British Army during World War II at the invasion, he was in charge of everything. Right?
Yeah. Well, it shows you that failure breeds success.
Yeah.
If you failed at everything you've done, and somebody's looking for a stooge, they say, well, this loony would be just ideal for our purposes. And Eisenhower was perfect. He went to London as the chief of all the forces, armed forces in Europe, and his chief assistant was Captain Edmund M. Warburg, who was Paul Warburg's nephew. And so nobody ever told Eisenhower anything. Everybody went through Captain Warburg. He was actually the chief of the
army. He was doing running everything.
Oh, he ran everything.
Now, that's news to me. That's good.
Well, you won't hear that from anybody else. It's in my book, I think, the Federal Reserve book. But I have so many stories like that. You see, I used to live at the National Press Club every day in Washington. I heard all the inside stories. I was told all these things. I could write 15 books because they told me.
You were friends with the head of the press club. What was his name?
George Simpson.
Yeah.
He was the founder of the press club, not merely the head of it. And he ran the whole thing because everybody had to. He chose the new president of the press club every year, which was the most prestigious post in Washington. If you were the president of the National Press Club, you were absolutely at the top of the pecking hierarchy in Washington. And in fact, George once got appointed an out-of-work newspaper man named Bill Hassett, and the poor guy was out of a job. This is during the Depression. And so George called up the White House and said, I've got a young man that's a good man. He needs a job. And so he went over to the White House, and he became the chief public relations officer of the White House. And he was with Franklin D. Roosevelt when he died. And he was immediately catapulted into world prominence because he was with Roosevelt when he died. And there was a great mystery as to whether Roosevelt had committed suicide or whether he'd been murdered, because it was all very likely.
Right.
And so, so they immediately sealed Roosevelt's casket, nobody could see him, and he was buried in the sealed casket. And so Bill Hassett was the only person that knew whether he was murdered or whether he committed suicide.
Did he ever talk or say what happened?
No. What happened was that Truman succeeded Eisenhower.
You mean Roosevelt?
Succeeded Roosevelt. And so they told Truman, the first thing you've got to do is keep Bill Hassett shut. Mouth shut. So they actually moved him into the White House, and he lived in the White House for the rest of his life. Nobody knows that. I've never heard of a newspaper man living in the White House, but he was.
How did you get acquainted with Ezra Pound? I think it was through some of your art friends, right? Didn't you go to Las Escuelas de Bellas Artes in Mexico?
Oh, Escuelas de Bellas Artes,
yeah.
In Mexico. That was in San Miguel.
So but, you went at San Miguel de Allende?
De Allende,
yeah.
Which was a very aristocratic suburb of Mexico City. The really wealthy people of Mexico City would go for the summer to San Miguel to get away from the heat and the pollution.
Mm-hmm.
And Mexico City was very polluted then, and still is today. In fact, you would choke to death there after about 20 minutes.
So you studied what, art there?
I studied art. I always intended to be nothing but an artist and a writer. And so when I was in college at Washington Lee, all of my classmates were the sons of very wealthy and influential people. And so they used to say, look at Mullins. He knows what he's going to do in life. And these guys were all going to be bums because all they would do is live off their family fortune. Uh-huh. And so they envied me because I had a role in life. And I thought, why are all these wealthy people envying me when I haven't got a penny? But they were right. I had more ahead of me in life than they did.
Sure, it certainly did. So while you were at Washington and Lee, is that when you met Pound, or this was that?
No, I'm coming up to that. At Washington Lee, they had no art department, and I wanted to be an artist. And so I started scouting around for an art school, and they had a very famous one at Black Mountain College in North Carolina, and then another famous one at Skowhegan, Maine. And so I was going to one of those two art schools. And then I found out a new school had opened in Washington called the Institute of Contemporary Arts. And it was very avant-garde, and it was fun. And of course, when I went there, most of the people were communists, they were running. Which I paid no attention to. At that time, I was totally oblivious to politics. And I had never voted and never belonged to any parties, so I didn't care whether they were communists or not. And so while I was there, they had a young professor from the University of Maryland who had taught Japanese throughout World War II, which meant he was a very key person in Army headquarters because he was one of the few people who could teach Japanese, which is a very difficult language. And I have lectured in Japan for years, and I still do not know one word of Japanese. So anyway, this Professor Fleming, in his spare time, he was going out and visiting Ezra Pound, who was a political prisoner for life at St. Elizabeth's Hospital, never to be tried and never to be released.
Because of his, what he did in World War II.
Yeah, and what he did was broadcast to the United States, stay out of World War II. Well, of course, we had a military-industrial complex, which was intent on our going to war, just as we did in World War I. And Roosevelt parroted his, he was a protege of Woodrow Wilson in the First World War. He was Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And so in 1916, Wilson campaigned on the slogan for re-election that he kept us out of war. And so he was re-elected on the promise that he kept us out of war. And as soon as he was re-elected, he took us into the war. And so Roosevelt, being his protege, followed exactly the same program. In fact, they had the same mentor, Colonel Edward House, who was a Rothschild agent during the Civil War, and because of his connections with both sides, he was able to keep the cotton coming to the cotton mills of England during the Civil War and kept the British in business because the shiploads of American cotton sailed out of New Orleans straight to London. Nobody bothered them. Nobody ever fired a shot at them because they were told to let these ships pass. So at the end of the Civil War, only one person in the South had any money, and that was House's father, the agent for the Rothschilds, and he had gold. So he took over the entire politics of Texas and became the political boss of Texas. And in this role, when the Democratic Convention of 1912 came up, he could pick and choose all of the candidates, all of the nominees, the delegates. And so he put up the money, and they went to the convention and nominated Woodrow Wilson so that he could sign the Federal Reserve Act into law and make the central bank a permanent feature of the American institution. So everything happened according to plan, and there was Woodrow Wilson as president, and he signed the Federal Reserve Act on December the 23rd of 1913. They wanted it to be as close to Christmas as possible to make it a Christmas present to the American people.
Getting back to Wilson, the Jews had control of him because of his affair with Mrs. Peck, right?
Well, that was one thing. They had control of him for a lot of things because he was a stooge for the wealthy and influential bankers on Wall Street. And most of his money came from National City Bank, which was a Rothschild bank, which was the bank which financed Rockefeller in the Standard Oil and later financed Edward Harriman in the Union Pacific.
So, which is the Bush family.
And the Bush family is a lackey of the Harriman family,
right,
who are lackeys of the Rothschilds. So actually, the Rothschilds don't even know the Bushes because they don't even talk to them. They're just underlings, you right. see.
They're down a few levels from
them. A few levels. No Rothschild would ever talk to a Bush.
I understand when Wilson was president of Princeton, he was having a torrid affair with Mrs. Peck.
Oh,
and
yes.
It was well known amongst the students, and they used to call him Peck's Bad Boy.
Peck's Bad Boy. The book came out called Peck's Bad Boy, and my mother was a child at that time, and one of her favorite books was Peck's Bad Boy. She knew, of course, they knew nothing about the origins of the term, but that was it. I still have a copy of that book, Peck's Bad Boy, one of the original editions.
Well, the students gave Wilson that name when he was president because everybody knew he was having an affair, apparently, but Mrs. Wilson.
Oh, well, I don't think she cared, really.
And then,
because Woodrow Wilson was practically an invalid, and it was figured he wasn't going to be around long anyway, because at 49, he had a complete nervous breakdown, and he lost his eyesight because he had such high blood pressure. Ordinarily would die of a stroke immediately at the time, but somehow he muddled through and became president of the United States.
I'm trying to remember you were talking about, was it Theodore Roosevelt?
Theodore Roosevelt was a cousin. He was a wealthier cousin of Franklin. The Franklin's family was sort of ne'er-do-wells. They were mostly alcoholics, and they didn't have much money. So, well, they were... The kind of cousins that you're ashamed of. I don't think Theodore ever acknowledged Franklin's presence. I don't know that they ever talked to each other.
Well, they pulled him out with the Bull Moose Party, didn't they? To ensure that Wilson got in, that wasn't that a story?
Well, the purpose of the Bull Moose Party was that in 1912, William Howard Taft was one of the most popular presidents we'd ever had. He was terribly overweight. He weighed about 350 pounds. But the people liked him, and the country was prosperous. Everything was going well. And it seemed that a certainty that Taft would be reelected. And this upset the bankers on Wall Street because they wanted the Federal Reserve Act signed. And there was no guarantee that Taft would sign it. So they decided they had to get rid of him. Well, what could they do with Woodrow Wilson, who had no charisma and could not possibly be elected president? So they had to get rid of Taft out of the way. So they called Theodore Roosevelt out of retirement, which he was very happy to do, because here he was all washed up and cast on the shore, and he was just going to wither there. And suddenly he gets this call from distance, come back, we need you. And so he rushed onto the scene and tooting his trumpet like the crazy person in the Arsenic and Old Lace
right.
Movie.
Teddy.
And it was an exact copy of the whole routine. So he came out as the Bull Moose candidate, which no one had ever heard of because there had never been a Bull Moose party. And so, he gloried in it. He was back in the front lines again.
And he took all the votes away from the Republicans.
He took it all and sailed in with Wilson. And people never knew what happened. How could Woodrow Wilson possibly have been elected in 1912? Because nobody liked him, nobody could talk to him, and he was an ivory tower professor at Princeton who didn't know anything of the real world, and so how could this man be president? And so instead of the popular Taft, we got this gloomy person who was afflicted. They didn't know he was going to live or not because of his high blood pressure, and he became president and signed the Federal Reserve Act.
What about Herbert Hoover? You told me he used to work for Rio Tinto. What's the story on him? In the stock market in England, remember that?
Well, Herbert Hoover was one of the most notorious swindlers in the world in 1900. And no one would hire him. He embezzled money from his clients all the time. And it was amazing that he kept out of jail. But to be a really good criminal, you have to have chutzpah. And so he had lots of chutzpah, and all the time that the gendarmes were chasing him and trying to lock him up, he kept right on with his swindling career. And so the Rothschilds heard about this guy, and they said, well, he's our kind of guy. So they made him a director of one of their principal operations, Rio Tinto Zinc, which was Spanish copper.
It's still an operation today.
Oh, it's one of the biggest metallurgical companies in the world. It's always been very wealthy and very prosperous. So they made him a director of Rio Tinto Zinc. So there again, you see failure, bleed, failure breeds success. If you failed at everything, then somebody will come along and put you in charge of the company.
Put you in the White House, too.
They put you in the White House. Absolutely. Well, they picked up John Kerry. He was a perfect candidate because he had never done anything in his life. He's a complete failure in everything except he married a rich woman, which takes a little talent itself. I was never able to do it myself, and I'm too old now to do it.
And but by the way, how old are you today?
I'm 83.
83.
Yeah. I only have 40 years of hard work in it.
And you have many books? You said 23 books you have to finish.
Well, 38 more that I have to write. And I have to write these books because every book that I've written was written out of necessity because people needed each one of these books, and I wrote a definitive reference work on each one of those. My book, Murder by Injection, is the only history of the American Medical Association. My book on the Federal Reserve System is the only history of the Federal Reserve System because there are many, there's 18 plagiarizations of it, and people used to ask me at meetings, well, Eustace, what about this other book? What do you think of that book? I said, it's absolutely a good book because the research is impeccable. They copied every word out of my book. And I had researched it all at the Library of Congress, and it's all authenticated by government documents. So nobody's ever challenged one word about the book in 53 years.
I think I interrupted you. You never did. I started to ask you how you met first time Ezra Pound.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. This
that
happens.
Was my fault.
I have so much to talk about. I could talk about 8 hours, and it would take me 8 hours to get back to Ezra Pound unless you reminded me to get back. Because I could tell you the whole history of the world, and which people like to hear anyway.
Sure.
And because it's the history that's not known, you won't read about it in the New York Times because it's not fit to print.
They don't want you to hear it either.
Well, it actually is not fit to print because it's a history of skullduggery and criminality. And I've spent the last 50 years of my life studying criminality, which I never intended to be a detective. And I'm an artist, and yet I'm condemned to spend my life working with criminals. It's a terrible sentence.
So back to Ezra Pound now.
Professor
Fleming. Communist professor you had, what was his name?
Rudd Fleming.
Yeah.
Rudd Fleming became a part-time instructor at this little art school.
Uh-huh.
His wife came also. He went there really to give his wife something to do. And so both of them went on the faculty as part-time unpaid instructors because it was a new school starting up and they couldn't pay anything. So he was a very good teacher. He was teaching me writing. And so he told me after a couple of weeks, he said, Eustace, there's somebody I want you to meet. And he said, I said, who is that? And he said, well, Ezra Pound. And I said, well, why would Ezra Pound want to meet me? I mean, I'm a dumb kid. What in the world are we talking about? And I really was embarrassed. And so he kept after me for 3 months to go and meet Ezra Pound.
Who was at St. Elizabeth's Hospital.
At St. Elizabeth's Hospital, imprisoned for life without trial. The Constitution guarantees you a speedy trial, but when you offend the people in power, then you lose all of those rights. As the people in Guantanamo Bay realize.
Yes, that's for sure. So after 3 months, made you decide to go and see Ezra?
Well, Rudd kept after me every week to go and see Ezra Pound. And one cold afternoon day in February 1948, it was dull and gloomy and so forth, and we were down there at the school, and he said, Eustace, we're going out to see Ezra now. Why don't you come along with us? So I said, all right. So I got the car, and we drove out there. And having a car was a great privilege in Washington because very few people had cars. If you weren't a government official, you didn't have a car. But they had a private car. They lived in a beautiful home in Chevy Chase, Maryland. And they drove around in their car. So we got the car and drove out to St. Elizabeth. And it was a very gloomy winter day. And St. Elizabeth was on this knoll overlooking the capital of the United States. And it was a gloomy place because it had been built in the Civil War. The purpose of the Civil War was to establish the federal government as the final power in setting up courts and insane asylums and prisons throughout the United States. It was the final enslavement of the American people. Of course, they knew nothing about
it. They still don't know.
They don't know. They thought that they fought to free the Negroes. Yeah. Well, actually, the Negroes were free anyway. They had a happy life on the plantations. They sang and played most of the day. In fact, they bankrupted most of the plantations because they did no work. And one of their principal victims was Thomas Jefferson, because Thomas Jefferson had 200 slaves, and he was one of the wealthiest men in the United States, inherited 2,500 acres of maybe 25,000, I'm not sure, of prime land from his father. It was quite well-to-do. And he drank French wine and had the best of food. He had 200 slaves. At that time, a healthy slave was worth $5,000 apiece. And so he had 200 slaves, so that's
$100,000
in cash right there. But really, it carried some problems, because you had to house and feed these 200 people. And these 200 people did no work, and they played and sang all day. And he had no overseer. The only way you could get work out of them was to have an overseer who would drive them to work. And so Thomas Jefferson was too kind to do that. And so because he was so kind to his slaves, he's been vilified ever since as a slave owner.
So, let's see, where were we now? We were talking about...
I want to say that when Thomas Jefferson died, as one of the richest men in the United States, he was totally bankrupt because these 200 slaves had eaten and drunk everything he had. He had nothing left. And he had to move out of his house, and they took his furniture and his books and all the artifacts. So the things you see in Monticello today are not the original furniture of Jefferson, because all of his furniture was sold at auction when he died.
Just to pay off his debts, huh?
And all his debts were enormous, because he lived in a sort of a dream world where you were a country gentleman, and you corresponded and had people house guests. He used to have about 30 or 40 house guests, and you can imagine he's already feeding 200 slaves, and he has about 40 other people there, and he's putting out the bills for all these people, because it wasn't a hotel. You couldn't collect any fees for this. And so when he died, his poor children found out they were really poor.
Didn't you say some of these retired CIA people have estates, these huge estates in Virginia with horses and stuff? Remember you said that in one of yours?
Oh, yes, they do have, because that was part of the black budget, you see. Their bank for the CIA was the not Snyder. It's a
Schroeder Bank.
The Schroeder Bank, and that was a German bank. And so when we won the war, we had the Schroeder Bank. We had plenty of banks here, J.P. Morgan, Kuhnloge, and so forth. But we chose the Schroeder Bank to handle all the black budget of the United States, because they had a budget of many millions of dollars, and it was unaccountable because it was a national secret as to where the money went, and has been to this day. And so Alan Dulles, the founder of the CIA, became a director of Schroeder Bank. Of course, there was no conflict of interest, because the money in this hand of Alan Dulles went to this hand. Nobody ever had a problem with it. And all of his associates began to buy these enormous estates in Northern Virginia outside of Washington, which today they're selling off, because they were usually 300 or 400 or 500 acres apiece, and that land is worth $1 million an acre today. So
they're subdividing them.
Subdividing everything. In fact, I had one friend, General Ben Parton, who was the chief explosives expert of the United States Air Force, and Ben lives in one of those houses, and I used to stay with him quite a lot, because I flew out of National Airport, which is now Reagan Airport, to celebrate the fact that Reagan defeated communism, which was a great joke, because Reagan had nothing to do with it. Joe McCarthy did the whole thing. But they preferred to give the credit to Reagan rather than Joe McCarthy.
Yeah.
Because Joe McCarthy was an evil monster. And you don't want an evil monster as a hero.
And he was really totally the opposite. He said he was a pussycat, right?
Oh, his secretary, Larry Lentz, came up to me a few years ago at a memorial service for him in Appleton, Wisconsin, and said, Eustace, we were standing right at Joe's graveside, and she said, Eustace, did you know that Joe was always a pussycat? And I said, Of course I knew that, because I knew him well, and this was a man who was so kind and so timid he wouldn't hurt a flea. He was the most gregarious person in Washington. Everybody loved him. And if you wanted to go out drinking or partying in the evening, you would want Joe McCarthy. He was the ideal person to have.
And now he got torpedoed by Shine, and what was the other one?
Cone and Shine.
Yeah, Cone.
Well, see, Cone was a, he was the son of Marcus Cone, who was the head of the Anti-Defamation League in New York City. And when Joe got into trouble financially, he needed money to keep the office going, because a senator only gets a certain allowance, and he was getting, when he started his fight against communism, he was getting 20,000 letters a day from people all over the United States, and he couldn't answer these letters. How does anybody answer 20,000 letters a day? So Marcus Cone offered to help him out and pay for the office expenses if he would take Roy Cone and David Shine on his staff, which McCarthy had no choice, really. He had to do it. So he agreed, because Roy Cone was a rising young lawyer, and Joe did not know at that time. He was a very flamboyant homosexual. Uh-huh. And you see, Cone was very, because I was working with McCarthy at the same time, and I never knew anything about Roy Cone being homosexual. He would go to New York every weekend and pay handsome young callboys $500 a night to sleep with him, which at that time was quite a bit of money.
Uh-huh.
And so he never did anything in Washington. There was never any hint of, I never heard a word about Roy Cone in Washington, because he was perfectly behaved there, because all of his exploits were in New York City. And they would fly to Capri. He was a good friend of Cardinal Sheehan and some of the other Catholic bigwigs. And they would have the parties up on Long Island at McDiff's in the States, which were completely closed to the public, and no newspaper reporters ever came there. And the thing almost blew up one time, because they had a bunch of boys on a yacht one weekend, and one of the kids got drunk and fell overboard and drowned. And it was all hushed up, but that almost blew the whole thing up right there. But they survived that.
When did you meet the Hunt? Mr. Hunt.
Oh, I had known Mr. Hunt for years, because one of my best friends was Les Hooker, and he was a wealthy young playboy, and he married Jane Barbie, who was the heir to the Vanity Fair fortune in the laundry company, one of the wealthiest women in the United States. And Les' family was quite wealthy themselves. They were Chicago millionaires. So they had this beautiful estate in Larchmont, New York, and so I used to spend most of my weekends there, because Wes and I ran around together a lot. And so Wes was doing some television and acting around. He was a playboy. He could do anything he wanted to. And so somebody put the bee in his bonnet, why don't you start a television network? Now, there were only three networks at that time. Somebody said, start a fourth television network. So West, even with his family's money, couldn't do that. But he got acquainted with H.L. Hunt. And Hunt, at that time, he told me later, he was featured in Life magazine as having an income of $1 million a week. And later on, when I was working with him, we spent all our days together. And so I said to him, we were chatting just like we are now, and I said, Mr. Hunt, I saw that Life report that you were making $1 million a week at that time. And he snorted. He said, they didn't know what they were talking about. That was the absolute nonsense. He said, I was making $10 million a week. And that really stunned me, because that's the sum of money that I could even envision.
You actually lived on their ranch when you were doing the research for Hunt, right? Didn't he set up a room for you at the ranch?
Oh, he didn't set up. What happened was...
Oh, no, that was for McCarthy.
Huh? Yeah. For Joe. He was a great patron of Joe McCarthy. And he built a special, beautiful, very elaborate apartment in his home for Joe to stay in. And unfortunately, Joe never stayed there but one night. And it was kind of kept as a shrine in his memory. So when I went to work for him, he was going to let me stay in his pool house by his swimming pool. And it was just a little hut. And I didn't care, because I'd slept in empty buildings for years. And to me, that was coming up in the world. But he became a little embarrassed to have me live there. So he moved me into the McCarthy apartment. And I stayed there all the time I was with Joe. I mean, with H.L. Hunt. And took my meals with the family. And They were very pleasant people. But there was practically no conversation at the dinner table because they had nothing much to talk about.
You've had quite a, let's see how much, we're just about out of tape here on this one, but I sure wish we could continue this.
You don't have any more tape? Huh?
Yeah, I do have more tape. Oh. If you're not in a hurry, I'll put another tape.
I'm not in a hurry because what happened was I got stranded here. They lured me into coming down here, promised me door-to-door transportation, and then when the people came down here, they said they dumped me here at the hotel, and they drove off. They said, we're going to Texas for a week.
Oh, no. So you're stuck here.
So I'm stuck here.
Holy
so God. I just told Jim Warner, I said, I'm moving out to your house. I'm going to be a permanent house guest. Because I'm famous for moving into people's homes and staying for 4 years. But only if they have lots of money. I wouldn't want to be a burden on them.
Okay, let me stop this tape and I'll pop another one in here.
Well, this is going very well.
Speaking about education, while the camera tape, we were changing tapes. Let's talk about John Kennedy and his assassination and his bringing back the. You said he never did get very much of an education. Where did he go to Harvard?
Harvard. Well, like
you said, he never studied history about the Lincoln assassination.
Well, they used to say about Harvard. Well. One of the great men of Harvard was asked one time about getting an education at Harvard, and he said it's impossible to get an education at Harvard. And that was in 1910, so you can imagine what it's like today.
What I was trying to allude to was the greenbacks. You remember when during the Civil War, when Lincoln needed the money, and he went to the bank, Jewish bankers in New York, and tell that story. They wanted the exorbitant interest, so he issued the greenbacks, remember?
Well, in 1848, at a wedding in the Rothschild family, Hannah Rothschild was getting married to Lord Rosebery, who later became the director or the foreign minister of the British Empire. And so they were having a family conference because these people never wasted a time. When they had a wedding, they would have important business and political conferences, and they would get a lot accomplished because in those days, travel was slow. And when you got together, you made the most of the time. So at their conference, they decided that the United States was growing too fast and becoming too powerful. So they resolved to split it up into two small banana republics, which they could control more easily. In other words, instead of the United States, we would have Guatemala and Yucatan.
Uh-oh.
Now what's happening?
We're going to have to move somewhere.
Oh, okay, we can move anywhere. I didn't know where this was going on. I don't know what's going on.
Maybe they're taking a break.
Well, I think it's a break, that's all.
Yeah.
See, during a break, they come into the book club.
I'm going to stop.
I don't think the actual meeting has occurred yet.
No, it hasn't.
Well, we'll have to get that in.
Let's go.
Okay.
We're rolling.
Well, when the Flemings took me to meet Ezra Pound at St. Elizabeth's Hospital, I think it was in February 10th, 1948, we drove out to St. Elizabeth's Hospital, the home for the criminally insane, where he was sentenced for life without trial. He never had a trial. He never was convicted of anything. But they boasted on Capitol Hill. I had friends inquire of Supreme Court Justice Tom Clark and General Lucius Clay, the hero of the Berlin Airlift. They were good friends of George Simpson. And he went to them and said, what is going to happen to Ezra Pound? And so they said, we'll make inquiries. And they came back and he said, well, they resolved that he will never leave St. Elizabeth's alive. A life sentence. He would die there. Well, that's where he wanted him. But the weakness of the whole plan was that during the 13 years that Ezra Pound was in St. Elizabeth's Hospital, he had a total of 3,800 visitors, many of them the most famous people in the world, and they went out and talked about his plight. So it kind of backfired on them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came along, and I knew a congressman that got him released. So
that was Birdie, right?
Birdie. And so the whole thing blew up in their face. And so I have since described myself as Ezra Pound's revenge. Because through me, he got revenge on the whole crowd of criminals for putting it away.
Didn't you say the first time you went there, the FBI opened a file on you, right?
Well, I knew, didn't know that till years later. We went to St. Louis and went to the this gloomy brick building. It was like an old medieval fortress. And so the door was opened by a guy with a bunch of keys at his waist. They were fully this big, about 200 keys. I mean, it was like a medieval jailer. And he opened the door, and we went in. And we walked into this rather gloomy place and down a hall. And there at the end of the hall was sitting Ezra Pound and his wife. And so it wasn't very auspicious. It was a very gloomy winter afternoon. And I was a little nervous. And then at the end of the hall, I saw this fine-looking man. He looked like King George V, actually. He had a little goatee. And was a very powerful-looking man. And that was Ezra Pound. So, and when I saw this man sitting there in his hellhole, I almost became so angry that I almost lost my mind. Because all of a sudden, the whole rottenness of the whole situation burst upon me. Why would anybody lock up a man like this? I mean, we had all kind of criminals in this country walking the streets, and here was Ezra Pound, the greatest literary talent in the world, locked up like a common criminal. And it was too much for me to handle. I was 25 years old, and I was very impressionable, and I thought this cannot be happening. So anyway, we walked up, and Ezra got up, and I had a very firm handshake. It was very vigorous. He was always more vigorous than any of the attendants or the other patients in the whole hospital.
Even after 13 years?
Well, he hadn't been there 13 years. He'd only been, been there a couple of years. They brought him over in 1945.
Oh.
So he'd only been there 3 years. So it hadn't really gotten to him yet. But 10 years later, he really began to come downhill a little bit. Because
and you were visiting him all that time, huh?
Well, I visited him every day. What happened was, after I met him, and we hit it off immediately, because whenever I met somebody like H.L. Hunt or Ezra Pound or Joe McCarthy, we hit it off immediately. And we never, it's just like rapport, and we never disagree about anything, we never quarrel about anything, we never criticize each other about anything. It's a wonderful thing. And so that's happened in every instance. Whenever I met a really sincere, dedicated person, we never have any conflict about anything. They don't have to go complaining about what a terrible person I am. I don't go around complaining about what a terrible person they are, because we're kinsmen, you know. We're just alike.
So after that initial meeting at Winter Day, you decided to go back and see him again.
Well, after our initial meeting, we sat down and talked, and it was time to go. 4 o'clock, we had to get up and leave. And so, as we left the hospital...
Go home, John! We don't want you.
Okay, we're doing video over here, please.
Do you want me to get out then?
No, it's okay.
I'll
shut up.
Okay. Is that on the tape?
Yeah.
Oh, good guys. Oh, Dan is Italian. He's like that. He's very impulsive. So anyway, so as we were leaving the building, Mrs. Fleming said to me, she said, Eustace, do you realize what's happened? Because as we were leaving, Ezra said to me, what day do you want to come? I didn't know what he was talking about. And I said, oh, Tuesday. He said, okay, your day is Tuesday. And so we left. And so when we got outside, Mrs. Fleming said, do you realize what's happened? I said, what? She said, you have your own day. And I said, what does that mean? She said, you have your own day that no one else can come on your day, Tuesday. And so this was all completely new to me. I didn't know what was going on. But anyway, they had reserved Tuesday for me as the date to visit Ezra Pound. And so from that time on, we went out on Tuesday. And later on, as my studies lightened at the art school, I began to go every day. And I took the bus because I had no car. And you could take a bus and you're right at the hospital. You picked up your bus, by the way, you picked up your bus at the FBI headquarters and got on the bus outside of Hoover's office and drove to St. Elizabeth.
Saved them a little trouble tailing, you know, they could just go right out the front door.
Well, I didn't know it for several years, but when I visited Ezra Pound, the FBI immediately opened a file on me because I was visiting a federal prisoner accused of a capital offense, high treason. And so they suddenly had a file on Eustace Mullins. There was nothing in it because I didn't know anything. Later on, as I became more active and writing a lot and becoming a public figure, they began to keep me under surveillance. And they surveilled me every day for 33 years. Teams of FBIs, I've spent millions of dollars on this. And they finally, after all these years of surveillance, they came up with a single conclusion. They said, Eustace Mullins is a sloppy dresser. That was all they could get on me.
Terrible crime.
Well, I was a sloppy dresser because I bought all my clothes at thrift shops and none of them fitted. So, in other words, everybody in the FBI was beautifully tailored because they would go to the best men's shops in whatever town it is, and they would get the most beautiful clothes and perfectly fitted, like a fine tailor. And, of course, they didn't charge them anything. I mean, you don't charge the FBI agents for things because you come under their protection. So whenever FBI agents came and called on me later on, I'd see two of the most beautifully dressed people in the world.
Well, right away you knew who they were.
Yeah. And the agents themselves were the only people dressed like that. The people who worked in the offices wore ordinary clothes.
So you said while you were visiting Ezra one day, he mentioned he wanted you to look something up at the Library of Congress.
Yeah, after I visited him for a few weeks, he said he decided I could be very useful. And he was always assigning people to do things. And he said, would you mind looking up something for me at the Library of Congress? Because I went there every day. And I said, of course not. He said, well, would you look up the Federal Reserve System? And I said, what is that? And he said, have you got a wallet with you? And I had a wallet, had a couple of dollars in. I pulled out a dollar. And he said, it says Federal Reserve at the top. And I'd never seen that, of course. Nobody ever looks
right.
at it. And so that was my introduction to the Federal Reserve System. And when I went to the Library of Congress, I was a great paroler. I got a stack permit. And I used to wander through the whole library, completely unsupervised. And I found stacks of books and pamphlets and documents that they didn't even know they had. Because I was a rooter, I'd go through everything. And so, and one shelf of which is mostly pamphlets, I started pulling out these pamphlets. They were all very interesting. And I found one which is a copy of an old magazine called Current Opinion, which was like Time Magazine in 1910. And this was the December 1910 issue, and it had the story of a meeting at Jekyll Island.
Wow.
And that introduced me to the whole thing.
The odds that you find in that were very slim, huh?
Oh, incredible. I used to find things like that. It was like God was telling me, look at this, and so I would. But it wasn't really that because I looked at everything. And most of it I cast aside as of no interest. But
so you brought that story from that magazine back to Ezra.
Yeah, and he hit the ceiling. He said, well, you've got to write this book as a detective story. And, of course, I had no interest in criminology, but I realized it was a detective story. And it's been a detective story ever since. A story that had the greatest brand of criminals in the world seized the money and credit of the entire United States of people and enslaved them with their own money. And that's what's happened today.
And they still do.
Yeah. Permanent slavery.
So how did Ezra stay in a total of 13 years?
13 and a half.
And you got him out, right?
Well,
Congressman Verrick or whatever his name was.
Well, what happened? No, I didn't get
Burdick.
Usher Burdick. What happened was that I had a friend, an old retired newspaper man named Rex Lampman. And Rex Lampman is the man who introduced me to George Stimson, who was the most influential newspaper man in Washington. And Rex also knew Bill Hassett, whom George had got a job at the White House. And at that time, Bill was living at the White House. And so one evening he said, we're going out tonight. And I said, where are we going? We're going to the Library of Congress. And he said, we're going to hear Thomas Mann. He said, Bill Hassett wants to hear him. And so that evening, a big black Cadillac from the White House pulled up and picked me up Rex and me, and took us to the White House.
You mean to the Library of Congress?
To the library. Well, we had to go to the White House first.
Oh, I see.
See, they sent the driver to pick us up.
I see.
And come back to the White House and pick up Bill Hassett, and then we drove to the Library of Congress.
I see.
And so, of course, being a White House limousine, we parked right out in front of the Library of Congress at the entrance and went in to hear Thomas Mann, who was at that time a very famous writer. And Thomas Mann was German, and we sat on the front row, and he started giving his lecture, and he had such a thick German accent that you couldn't understand one word he said. He was speaking English, but it was so heavily accented. So I never got anything out of the lecture. It was totally unintelligible, but it was a great evening. And there I'm sitting, I'd come in a White House limousine, and I'm sitting with one of the principal people at the White House, Bill Hassett, whom everybody in the world wanted to talk to, mm-hmm. to ask him what had really happened to Franklin D. Roosevelt. Of course, he never talked.
He stayed silent until he died.
Until the day he died.
Because he knew if he talked, he would die.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it was not only that. It was the code of a newspaper man or a banker or whatever. You don't tell what you learned except to authorized sources. So he was, Bill never breathed one word, and you can imagine that was the greatest mystery in the United States. What happened to Roosevelt? Any newspaper would have given him $1 million for that story.
Sure. Well, people had integrity in those days.
Well, they did.
Some of them did. Anyway.
Oh, Bill had integrity. He was a good guy. And I never heard of him again after that. He finally died at the White House, I believe, and was buried, and that was the end of it. And the interesting thing is that where I live in Stanton, Virginia, today, right behind the house that we have, is the Hassett family house. I look out my back door, and I'm right there at the Hassett
house. That's where he grew up.
Apparently, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So everything comes around full circle. It's really amazing.
Amazing. Small world.
It becomes smaller all the time. After I'd been doing this work about 50 years, I found out that I was writing all my books about the same people. And it was so easy because I had their complete biographies committed to memory, and I could write my books just without looking up anything.
Sure.
It was so amazing because first I wrote about the money conspiracy, the Federal Reserve.
Was that your first book?
Hold on. That was my first
Secrets
book.
Of the Federal Reserve?
Secrets of, I wrote that in 1953. It was published, my first published book.
Mm-hmm.
And then I followed it in 2 years later with a book called The World Order, which is about the secret government of the world. And the book did not sell at all because I never advertised my books and they were never reviewed in any newspaper. I sent out review copies sometimes, but they always threw them in the trash. Well, I don't know if they threw them in the trash, but they had instructions not to review them or mention them. I mentioned my name, and my name is practically never mentioned in any newspaper in the world. And the names of my books are never mentioned.
Even though all the government agencies subscribe and buy all your books?
Oh, yeah.
Like, for instance, the Federal Reserve, as you said, had bought every copy.
Every edition.
Every edition.
Because I reprinted it every few years, it would sell out, and I'd reprint some more. And each time I reprinted it, it was not announced anywhere. It was not advertised anywhere, but I would get a check from the Federal Reserve System for the new edition. So who told them? I have no idea.
And you said one day that you went up to visit, what's his name, the head of the Federal Reserve then.
Oh, Joseph Coyne. He was the chief administrator.
And you saw the book on the shelves, all the editions of your
book. I had no idea such thing was going on. But what happened was I did do most things by impulse. And so I was over there one day in that area, and I was at the 21st and Constitution is where the Federal Reserve Building is. And I had never dreamed of going in there. I had no reason to really go because I'd done all the research for the book, and the book was published. But just on the spur of the moment, I found a parking place. You could still find a parking place in those days. I parked on the meter, which at that time you only had 25 minutes. And walked in the front of the Federal Reserve, and I walked up to the guard, and I said, I knew the name of Marshall Coyne, I think because he had corresponded with me on something. He sent me a letter, and I knew it was Marshall Coyne, the chief, C-O-Y-N-E, who was the chief administrative officer of the entire Federal Reserve Board of Governors, which, as you can imagine, is one of the most important positions in Washington.
Sure.
And his name is never mentioned in the press whatsoever. And so I walked up to the guard, and of course he was very suspicious. I was a young person. What business did I have there? Obviously, I was moderately dressed, but not impressively so. And he said, do you have business here? And I said, yes, I'm here to see Marshall Cohen. And so he went to the phone, and he rang his office. And
was it Joseph Cohen?
Joseph Cohen. You're right. You're sharper than I am. Well, I'll tell you, so many years have passed, and so many years.
Right.
But it is Marshall.
Joseph Cohen.
And so I was called to the telephone, and it was Cohen's secretary. And she said, you want to see Mr. Cohen? And I said, yes, I'd like to see him. And she said, do you have an appointment? And I said, well, no. She said, well, Mr. Cohen never sees anyone without an appointment. And I said, just mention my name to him. It's Eustace Mullins this year. And so she, of course, the name meant nothing to her. She said, well, I'll tell him. And so she walked away and apparently told him. And she came right back to the phone and said, Mr. Cohen says for you to come on up. But you can only stay a couple of minutes because he has an important engagement, an important conference. And so I said, that's all right with me, because I was on a 20-minute parking meter, and I don't want to get my car towed away.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just wanted to see him, say hello. So I walked up the head of this marble stairs. It was like walking up Versailles Palace. And
going up to heaven. Huh?
Going up to heaven. And at the top of the stairs, there was a balcony and some offices, and there was Joseph Cohen.
Yeah.
Joseph Cohen's was right at the head of the stairs. And so I walked in the office, and I told him who I was, and he was a very nice-looking person, and he was obviously very interested in meeting me. I guess they've been talking about me for years. And, of course, I had no idea of this. I thought, I don't even know why this guy's seeing me, but I'm glad he is. So we sat down and started talking, and he was trying to give me all kinds of propaganda. He said, now, Mr. Mullins, you must know that it's an part of the Federal Reserve System is that every person who owns every bank that owns Federal Reserve Bank stock has equal voting rights. In other words, National City Bank with 155,000 shares of Federal Reserve stock has no more influence than this little country bank that owns 2 shares. And I said, no, I didn't know that. Of course, that was totally.
Sorry, I don't have it.
Of course, that was total nonsense. But I listened to him.
Yeah, thanks.
And I wasn't there to disagree with him. I said, I never thought about that.
And you knew it was a lot of malarkey.
Well, I never thought about it because it was so silly that I would never. So anyway, that was the tenor of our conversation. So we sat there and we talked for about a half hour. And I was getting worried about
our car. Hello, Eustace. Are you in an interview right now?
Yeah.
What's going on right now?
We can stop it, though.
Okay,
go ahead.
Thanks. Sorry.
Okay, we're back on land.
All right.
So you were you had your money in the parking meter. You were up there talking to Joseph Cohen at the Federal Reserve.
And he didn't mention again this important conference, which happens never existed. It was just an excuse so the secretary could come in 5 minutes and get rid of this guy. And so once he had me there, he would have kept me out there all day. And so we kept talking. And so finally, I was worried about my car. So I said to him, well, I said, I don't want to take up too much of your time. But he had absolutely no interest in getting me out of there. So I finally said that I would have to go. And I got up and left. And when I got my car, nothing had happened. Luckily, I hadn't been ticketed or anything. The car was still there, and which was a load off my mind. So I drove on back to my hotel. And that was the end of it.
It's quite a story.
And I went back to the Federal Reserve later to use the library. They have a little private governor's library, which is not much bigger than a closet, and it's lined with books about the Federal Reserve System itself. Of course, there aren't that many, but I looked on the shelf, and they had every edition since the initial edition of my Federal Reserve, about 8 at that time. And I thought, what in the world are they doing with all these books?
They're keeping track of you, that's what.
Well, obviously they are now, but at that time I couldn't understand it, because although I was interested in the Federal Reserve, I couldn't figure out that they would be interested in it, because of all people, they should know the history of it themselves.
Yeah, but they wanted to see what other people meant.
Well, that's exactly it. And at the time, I was still very naive about things like that. And I didn't understand the way you control things is you keep track of everybody.
When did you start your lecturing? What year about was that?
Well, actually, I started some lecturing at the art school I was going to. Uh-huh. Because we had many of the prominent artists and writers in the world came there to lecture because it was a very select school. It was a small school, and we had many famous writers there. I could hardly remember their names. And so every once in a while, one of us would, if a speaker didn't show up, one of us would fill in. And so I did some talking there, and I found out that if it was a subject I knew about it, I could talk about it very fluently. So that's when I started lecturing.
But I mean lecturing on, let's say, what we're talking about now.
Well, then years later on, as my book began to be circulated more and more, I became in demand as a speaker at very small groups like that. Well, not even this big. Most of the groups were 10 or 15 people. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting to get up and talk about it. And, of course, in those days, there was no charge. It was just open to the public. And I didn't get money from it, but it was a way to learn to speak. And when I learned to speak, when I first started speaking, I was very hesitant and very nervous. I think the first time that I ever delivered a lecture, I was so nervous, I had to hold on to the podium with both hands to keep from falling down. But of course, you get over that. I was giving a lecture once in Dallas, and I lectured, and this lady came up to me, and she said, "You are certainly the worst speaker I've ever heard." She said, "You just recite facts and figures." She said, "You have to learn how to interest people in what you're doing." And she was perfectly right, but she was very rude to do it. And I buckled down, and I learned to become a better speaker. I picked up lines from television comedians and things like that, and jokes, and I became very fluent in that. And it didn't take but a short time, and I was becoming a very successful lecturer. So.
And you have a total of how many books now? 13?
13.
13 books.
And 38 more, which I have to get out.
You better get to work quick.
Well, I'm working all the time already.
Oh, let's see. What else haven't we covered? We haven't covered the wars, the world wars. Well, like you said, I remember in one of your talks, you said you're trying to give 5,000 years of history in 30 minutes or 60 minutes or something uh-huh. like that.
Well, I've learned to do that. 60 minutes will pretty well cover it, actually. and 15 minutes will cover the United States because I'm going to do a banker's history of the United States.
Is that a book you plan on doing?
Well, it'll really be a pamphlet. It's only about 10 pages. Because it simply lists all of the wars of the United States since 1775. And with each war, I give the secret history of how that worked. The first one, the War of 1812, the Rothschilds set up the first central bank of the United States. It was called the First Bank of the United States. And George Washington signed a charter for it. And Thomas Jefferson was the Secretary of State, and he bitterly opposed it. Because Thomas Jefferson, for some strange reason, a farmer in Virginia, knew more about banking than anybody else who's ever occupied the White House.
I think he spent time in Europe. Maybe that's where.
Well, he must have picked it up in Europe, because you couldn't even pick it up in this country was nothing but frontier at that
probably
time.
Probably didn't even have many banks.
Well, they didn't have many banks, and most of the bankers they had didn't know what they were doing, so you couldn't learn much from them. But anyway, Jefferson, he may have been a very retentive person, because some people, they can walk by or something and pick up everything in it in a couple of minutes. So I think he was like that. So he had an open mind, and he wanted to learn. And see, the important thing about learning is wanting to learn. See, we have our schools in the United States are filled with children who don't want to learn about anything, and the teachers have a terrible time. They got to convince each child individually that he ought to learn this lesson, and they couldn't care less. They're waiting for the schools to get out so they can go and play baseball.
So Jefferson, now let's get back to the Jefferson. He he was against the bank, the first charter.
Well, George Washington signed
the first charter.
He was the president. He was in charge. So Jefferson could do nothing about it.
But and Jefferson, that was Hamilton that was responsible for that, right?
Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah. Who was a Rothschild agent.
He was a Rothschild agent. And to this very day, all of the conservatives in the United States are called hard money people, and they're followers of Alexander Hamilton. And they won when they got the Federal Reserve Act in 1912, because when we went under the Federal Reserve System, we became a permanent central bank, and the bankers were totally in charge. So Jefferson then became president, and the charter of the First Bank of the United States came up for renewal. It must have been for 10 to 12 years. And so it came up for renewal, and Jefferson had a chance for his revenge. He refused to sign the charter. So what happened was the Rothschilds at the Bank of England in London, of course they were infuriated by this, and they decided to slap down this upstart, so they made it declared war. And this was the only reason for the War of 1812, and it's not in any history book in the world today. You cannot read any history book that'll tell you that England declared war on the United States in 1812 because Jefferson refused to renew the charter of the Bank of the United States.
They'll give you some sad excuse like we were impressing seamen or something.
Well, they were impressing foreign seamen on the open sea. And that happened a few times.
But it wasn't.
Oh, it had nothing to do with it.
Right.
You can imagine today if somebody hauls a couple of seamen off of some little American boat, you immediately declare war on this. Of course, you don't do that.
No,
you send them a note of protest. That's all you do.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, that's the only thing that school children know about the War of 1812, because they don't want to talk about the Bank of the United States or any bank. And so, anyway, that's where we were in this war. And I think the Rothschilds decided that this new republic was too hard to control, and with the War of 1812, they're going to knock it out of existence.
Mm-hmm.
And so they attacked the city of Washington, our capital, and they wanted to absolutely destroy the entire city. And they burned the Capitol and thought that would be the end of it. But and it would have been except for one person, and that was Andrew Jackson. And Andrew Jackson was the tough Indian fighter on the frontier. And you can imagine you had to be pretty tough to survive in those days, because living in the United States was no picnic.
That's right.
And so Andrew Jackson decided to fight, and he wound up in New Orleans, right where we're sitting today, at Chalmette, and had a ragtag group of revolutionary soldiers wearing odd uniforms, and they all had muskets, and they were expert shots. So the British troops in their red uniforms, in perfect order, marched across the swamps toward New Orleans. It's a very powerful organization, and so nobody had written a book about it. So I found a little book at the Library of Congress called The Drug Trust by a man named Morris Beale. And he was a Washington news reporter whose wife had had some minor ailment, and she went to the doctors, and she was so mistreated that it made her husband furious. And so he started looking at the medical profession, and he was appalled by what he found out. So he started studying the medical profession, and he wrote a little book about 20 pages long called The Drug Trust. And on the first page of this book, he said that he had found out that every drug manufacturer in the United States was controlled by John D. Rockefeller. Well, I thought that was a very foolish statement. I couldn't believe that. And so I decided to do a little more research and show that he'd kind of exaggerated. I wasn't calling him a liar, but I just didn't think he had his facts right. So as I looked into it, I found out that indeed every drug company in the United States was controlled by the Rockefellers, because it was very obvious on the list of directors of every major drug company in the United States were people from Standard Oil and from Chase Manhattan Bank and from other Rockefeller companies. So it was right there in front of me. There was no arguing about it. John D. Rockefeller.
So the man was right.
The man was absolutely right. Well, he was a newspaper reporter, and so he knew what he was talking about, but I just simply could not absorb that, because I knew that John D. Rockefeller was the owner of Standard Oil of New Jersey, the greatest monopoly in the world, And in my naivete, I'm a very country boy, I'm very naive, and I thought, if this is the richest man in the world, and he has the greatest corporation in the world, what does he want to fool around the medical profession for?
Yeah.
Because that wasn't a very highly paid profession in those days, but it was part of the control. And he saw new worlds to conquer, and he took over the entire medical profession in the United States. He started some of his hirelings. He had three brothers working for him named Flexner, Abraham and Bernard and Richard Flexner. And Abraham Flexner was one of his lieutenants, and he commissioned him to make a study of the entire medical profession. And so Abraham worked on it about 8 months, and he came back with a study recommending the revamping of the entire medical profession. At that time, most Americans either went to allopathic physicians or naturopathic physicians, homeopathic physicians. Homeopathic and
naturopathic.
That was the medicine of the United States. It depended mostly on organic substances and natural substances. They worked very well. The Americans at that time were the healthiest people in the world. And they were so vigorous that you can't believe it, because there were no automobiles, and most Americans did not have horses and carriages, and they had to walk everywhere. And so,
plus, they were hard working, too.
They were hard workers. They worked very hard, and they walked 25 miles a day. And they were in very good shape. And that's what they should be doing today. So anyway, Abraham Flexner submitted his report to Rockefeller, and he agreed with it and told him to go ahead with it. And so at that time, Rockefeller was the most hated man in the United States, and he was trying to set up a Rockefeller Foundation. But he was so hated that Congress refused to, even with wholesale bribing, they refused to authorize the Rockefeller Foundation. So he thought it was more clever, because at that time, J.P. Morgan had set up U.S. Steel Corporation, which was an amalgamation of the Carnegie interests and other steel companies, and created a world steel monopoly, just like the oil monopoly. And so, you see, Carnegie was a little Scotchman who became a very wealthy man through the coal operation and the manufacture of steel. And he became one of the richest men in the world. And as he grew older, he devoted his work to his life to charity. He set up libraries all over the United States. He was really a very good man. And he was a virtuous man, which Scotch people are. They're thrifty and they're very virtuous. So, because I'm Scotch myself, my mother was a muse and from Scotland. So anyway, as a virtuous man, Carnegie wanted to give away his money, didn't want anything to do with it, or he didn't want to manage it or dictate how it was used. And so when he set up the five Carnegie Foundations, he specified that he would have no personal interest in the operation of any of them. So he had five huge foundations to indulge in philanthropy, and he himself would have nothing to do with it. And so when Rockefeller learned about these five foundations, he immediately rushed in and put people in charge of them, and they became Rockefeller Foundations. And so,
with Carnegie's money.
With Carnegie's money. And and Carnegie thought he was being very virtuous in these millions of dollars being spent for philanthropic use. But Rockefeller had a different opinion. He thought that philanthropy should serve his business interests, and so all Rockefeller philanthropies became part of the Rockefeller business empire. He thought this was just good business. It worked out pretty well.
Yeah.
Because all the Rockefeller philanthropies helped the Rockefeller business interests.
Mm-hmm.
And so Rockefeller took over the Carnegie revamping of the medical profession, and they issued a report in 1913, the same time that they adopted the Federal Reserve Act, that that the number of doctors in the entire United States should be cut by two-thirds, and they adopted a whole new system called the allopathic system of medicine from Germany.
Which is drugs.
Well, drugs.
Artificial.
Well, the allopathic German system depended on radical surgery, and long hospital stays and heavy use of drugs. And so this Rockefeller thought this was terrific. And so they've been on it. They've been on allopathic system ever since. Almost overnight, neuropathy and homeopathy disappeared in the United States. In fact, they practically became illegal.
Yeah.
Because as the legislatures under Rockefeller's leadership, he set up the American League of Municipalities, which controlled all the small towns in the United States, and the American Association of State Governments, which controlled all the state governments in the United States, including the legislatures. And he used the state legislatures to draft new methods for controlling doctors and hospitals. And so all hospitals and all doctors had to be licensed through state legislature, which sounded wonderful if you didn't know what was going on. That you had to go through John D. Rockefeller to get a medical license and a hospital license.
Wow.
That's what it amounted to. And that's the system we have today. And today we've become the sickest nation in the world and the most expensive medical care in the world, except you never get well. Which seems to work out for everybody except the patients.
Where it's good for the doctors, isn't it?
Good for the doctors.
It's drug companies.
Oh, yeah. So everybody's happy except the poor patients. And whenever you go to a doctor today and he prescribes a medicine for you, he says, you're going to have to take this medication for the rest of your life because it's against AMA principles to ever cure anybody. They've actually brought doctors up on charges of curing people. And they've drummed some of them out of the AMA for that very reason, because you're curing people. Because this might be the right thing to do, but from a business standpoint, it's better to keep them sick and
sure.
keep them buying the medicine, which they buy from the Rockefeller drug companies, and go to the Rockefeller hospitals, and everybody's happy.
And now they have the scam where if you can't afford it, the government's going to buy the drugs from the Rockefellers and give it to you, right?
Well, that's why they had the Medicare system, because they developed Medicare. You know, I point out in my book, Murder by Injection, that for many years the AMA spent millions of dollars in Congress to fight Medicare because it was called government medicine, and they didn't want, the doctors were very independent, and they didn't want the government to control their business. Well, they wound up as employees of the government, and that's what they're.
And now this new drug act, they're going to supply the drugs to the people that can't afford it with the taxpayers' money, but the drug companies will still get the money.
They get the money.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the people who are buying drugs today and medications, like elderly people like myself, they couldn't afford the drugs, and so the government will pay for them.
What a racket.
Well, it shows that these people are good businessmen.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. They're not very ethical, though.
Well, you and I could never think of such a diabolical plan.
I remember in one of your lectures you covered getting back to the Civil War, how they sent... was it Freemasons from the north down to the south giving out guns? Forming
yeah.
militias, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was a secret Masonic organization.
Out of Cincinnati, was it?
Cincinnati, which it's all in my book. And so, you see, they couldn't have a war between the north and south because the south had no army. And the southerners were hunters and farmers, and they did a little hunting. They had guns. They could use guns, but they had no army whatsoever. And so they sent these Masons down in the south, and they went to every town in the south, and in every town they set up a little hunting club in which the people were trained and they could use guns already, but they were trained in elementary military drills and maneuvers, and that was the base of the whole Southern Army. As Clark Gable pointed out in Gone with the Wind, the South had no chance in the Civil War because they had no munitions factories. And he was almost mobbed when he said that.
That's right.
Because it showed he was very unpatriotic. And he was challenged to a duel.
Right.
So Hollywood sometimes gets it right. That was actually the sentiment at times.
So they came south and set up these little militia units to set up a pseudo-military system so that at least they'd have a pretense for
the
war.
Yeah, they spent many millions of dollars. This wasn't a small enterprise. Because they had to do with this all over the South, town by town,
uh-huh.
and county by county, and they did it.
Wow.
And in 2 years, they had elementary drills all over the South. And that was the basis of the Southern army which had not existed before, and so they could have a war. And then other Masons, the Scottish Rite in Charleston, South Carolina, they were intended as the triggers for the war. And the Scottish Rite people, they had this little inconspicuous fort at Charleston called Fort Sumner,
right,
which was of no military significance whatsoever. It was at the mouth of the harbor,
right,
but it could be taken by a force of 15 men, and it had never been used. And so they had some Scottish Rite people start firing guns at them. And so Lincoln immediately claimed that the North had been invaded, and in retaliation, he invaded the South and laid waste the entire country.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah. So that
was all according to plan, except they intended to divide it into two separate nations.
Well, the Rothschilds intended to do that, but they got Lincoln in as president, and Lincoln had this messianic zeal to make the Union permanent forever and reunite the North and the South.
And that thwarted their plans, and then...
Well, it thwarted their plans, but they found out it was better because they had one huge dictatorship instead of two smaller countries, which they had originally envisioned, and it turned out good for them, better than the original plan, really.
But at that time, remember, Lincoln ran out of money, I think he said in the lecture, so he went to the bankers in New York, and they offered him, what, 19% interest?
19%. Well, you see, it was not that they ran out of money. They had no money. And you can't have a war without money. So Lincoln had his treasurer call in the bankers and say, he said, well, we're going to need some money to finance this money. But they said, Mr. President, we're going to have to charge you 19% or 21. They went up to highest 24%. And he was appalled. He said, well, we can't pay that. But they said, well, it's a very risky loan, and so we have to do that. And so he was a little upset. He conferred with his Secretary of the Treasury, and he reminded him that as president, he could issue non-interest-bearing currencies. Now, when I first met Ezra Pound, he said, you have to learn the difference between non-interest-bearing currency and interest-bearing currency. Well, he could have been talking Greek to me. I had no idea what he's talking about. It was very simple. There was currency that bore interest. It was interested by the bank, which they got very good interest off of. And there was non-interest bearing currency, which carried no interest and which was a much lesser charge to the people, which is much better.
But the bankers didn't like that.
Well,
there was no interest.
Yeah, it was no interest. And it was less money. So they didn't want non-interest bearing currency. So they decided they would have to have interest-bearing currency. But Lincoln financed the war with the greenbacks, non-interest-bearing currency, and he finally got rid of them. He got the money, and they got rid of Lincoln because they had him murdered. And that was the only reason he was murdered. And it was so strange.
Can we interrupt you for a little while?
Okay.
Can we interrupt you just for a little while?
Sure.
Sorry. Okay. You can. All right. He's just...